Hey, everyone. We're going to be back next week with a brand new episode of the TED Radio Hour. But in the meantime, check out this one from our archives. It's called Beyond Tolerance, and it's about moving away from just tolerating people to actually trying to understand who they are. And you're going to hear from TED speakers, including Arthur Brooks, Vernae Myers, and Aspen Baker. This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So, tolerance.
Should I read you the statement?
We thought it was a pretty good time to do a show
Donald J. Trump
about tolerance.
He's calling for it. Now, listen, you got to listen to this one because this is pretty heavy stuff and it's common sense.
Of course, we don't have to tell you what's going on in U.S. politics.
By the way, just a question. Did President Obama ever come to a jamboree?
Or anytime you turn on cable news.
The Klan is a terrorist organization that has killed...
A leftist terrorist organization.
You can put whatever label you want.
I'm an American. American lives matter.
This masked ISIS militant gloats.
And the flames of war are only beginning to intensify.
As he presides over the executions of...
Or, for that matter, what's been happening in countries where they're dealing with refugees and changing populations in ways that you would not exactly describe as tolerant.
We are for the Christian Jewish culture.
We have to show them that people don't want them here.
Okay, you get the point. You know what I'm talking about, right? You probably don't need any convincing that the world kind of seems like a pretty intolerant place today. But how about this idea that the solution to all of this is not more tolerance? Tolerance, in fact, doesn't even come close to what we need.
Yeah, I know. Look, it's, you know, when you talk about a couple that's been together for 40 years and they really hate each other, you'll say, well, yeah, they barely tolerate each other. You know, I don't know why they don't get divorced. They barely tolerate each other. Well, hey, they're practicing tolerance.
Right.
Isn't that a great virtue?
Yeah.
No. It's not a great virtue. Tolerance.
This is Arthur Brooks. He runs a think tank called the American Enterprise Institute that, just to be clear, most people think of as right of center.
They do, although we have a lot of people all over the place. Personally, I'm a political independent.
Anyway, Arthur Brooks gave a TED Talk all about tolerance and why we talk about it like it's some kind of reasonable goal.
We talk about tolerance because we have low standards, basically. It's not enough to tolerate people. It's not even enough to help people. We need to need people who are not like us. And only when we do that can we have a kind of a unity that we really crave.
Easier said than done, of course. So today on the show, beyond tolerance. Ideas not just for coexisting, but really about respecting each other, about working together, even thriving together. And we're going to hit all of the third rails today. Race, abortion, politics, and just for good measure, Israel-Palestine. It's all here on this episode. So let's start with politics. And Arthur Brooks again, here he is on the TED stage.
Now, I don't have to tell anybody in this room that we're in a crisis in America and in many countries around the world with political polarization. There was an article last year in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, and it was an article in 2014 on political motive asymmetry. What's that? That's what psychologists call the phenomenon of assuming that your ideology is based in love, but your opponent's ideology is based in hate. Okay, now it's common in world conflict. You expect to see this between Palestinians and Israelis, for example. What the authors of this article found was that in America today, a majority of Republicans and Democrats suffer from political motive asymmetry. A majority of people in our country today who are politically active believe that they are motivated by love, but the other side is motivated by hate. Think about it. Think about it. Most people are walking around saying, you know, my ideology is based on basic benevolence. I want to help people. But the other guys, they're evil and out to get me. You can't progress as a society when you have this kind of asymmetry. It's impossible. Irreconcilable differences, right? We'll never come together. Wrong. That is diversity in which lies our strength. We need each other. In other words, if we want to help people, there's no other way.
So when you say that we have to not just tolerate people but that we disagree with, but we have to need them, how do you will yourself to need people that you kind of don't really, you know, want to hang out with?
Well, part of that is a moral decision, but part of that is actually really, really practical. You got to take things personally when you're going to understand the nature of needing other people. Do you need your sister-in-law? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to banish her to another country and never see her again. She might very well disagree with your politics. You know, somebody in your family who feels this way, your cousin, your mother, your spouse. And once we start taking it personally about people who are not like us, then we'll understand the nature of what it means to need other people. That's one way to do it. The second thing to keep in mind is that very practically, we need people who are not like us. You know, in the great period of American immigration between 1880 and 1920, that's the time when the sign on the base of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your poor," that actually meant something.
Yeah.
You know, come here, build our country. You know, my great-grandparents and yours, I mean, they came here for a reason. There was something they wanted to do. There was something they wanted to build. This country actually needed them. Well, Guy, since you and I were kids, I guess, that's changed.
I mean, I get that part. I mean, the economy has changed and jobs have changed. So, I mean, what's the connection between that and intolerance? Is it that, you know, when people don't feel like they're needed, they become less tolerant?
Well, actually, it's not. See, it's more complicated than that. For the last 7 and 10 years, the working class in the United States has seen effectively zero income growth. That means no progress. And that means bitterness. And that means I got to look for culprits. And that's when political opportunism comes in. And people who preach intolerance through populism can say either pull up the drawbridge, kick them all out, or off with their heads. Rich people, they got your stuff. That's when we fall prey to that. And that's where intolerance tends to breed.
But you know what we really need? We need a new day in flexible ideology. We need to be less predictable, don't we? Do you ever feel like your own ideology is starting to get predictable? Kind of conventional? Do you ever feel like you're always listening to people who agree with you? Why is that dangerous? Because when we talk in this country about economics, you on the right, conservatives, you're always talking about taxes and regulations and big government. And on the left, liberals, you're talking about economics, it's always about income inequality, right? Now, those are important things, really important to me, really important to you. But when it comes to lifting people up who are starving and need us today, those are distractions. We need to come together around the best ways to mitigate poverty using the best tools at our disposal, and that comes only when conservatives recognize that they need liberals and their obsession with poverty, and liberals need conservatives and their obsession with free markets. That's the diversity in which lies the future strength of this country if we choose to take it. So how are we going to do it? I'm asking you, and I'm asking me, to be the person specifically who blurs the lines, who's ambiguous, who's hard to classify. If you're a conservative, be the conservative who's always going on about poverty and the moral obligation to be a warrior for the poor. And if you're a liberal, be the liberal who's always talking about the beauty of free markets to solve our problems when we use them responsibly. If we do that, maybe, just maybe, we'll all realize that our big differences aren't really that big after all. Thank you.
Arthur Brooks, he runs the American Enterprise Institute, and you can see his entire TED Talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas for moving beyond tolerance. Do you think that it's hard for most people to talk about race?
I know a bunch of people who talk about race pretty constantly, like almost every minute of the day, right? Yeah. So it kind of depends on who you are. Is it hard for white people to talk about race? Some of them, absolutely least favorite subject.
But that's exactly what Verne Myers tries to get people to do. She goes into companies and she gets people to talk about the things that make them most uncomfortable. Ethnicity, religion, gender, race. And she does this so they can work better together. Even though a lot of us grew up thinking that tolerating someone of a different race meant trying not to notice their race.
In some ways, it was a great idea because a long time ago when we noticed color, we were doing bad things. So I think that's why people are like, don't notice color. But I also think people misunderstood it. I think we were just saying, don't use your color, people's color against them. Hmm. Don't think of their color as less than. But it didn't mean, like, don't pay attention to whatever race or ethnicity that you're from. And so I think we kind of have gone as far as we can go with not paying attention.
Verne is African-American, but she says that no matter what color you are, if you want to move beyond tolerance, you have to face up to your own biases. And that's what she talked about on the TED stage.
So I'm going to tell you to walk toward your discomfort. And you know, it's not the hardest thing to do, but it's one of these things where you have to be conscious and intentional about it. You know, I was on a Wall Street area one time, like maybe several years ago, and I was with a colleague of mine, and she's really wonderful, and she does diversity work with me, and she's a woman of color, she's Korean. And we were outside, it was late at night, and we were sort of wondering where we were going, we were lost, and I saw this person across the street, and I was thinking, oh, great, black guy. You know, he was a black guy. I think, you know, black guys generally know where they're going. And she was like, oh, that's interesting. She was saying, oh, you were going, yay, black guy? She said, I was going, black guy. Other direction, same need, same guy, same clothes, same time, same street. Different reaction. And she said, I feel so bad, I'm a diversity consultant, I did the black guy thing. I'm a woman of color, oh my God. And I said, you know what, please, we really need to relax about this. I mean, you gotta realize I go way back with black guys. My dad is a black guy. You see what I'm saying? I got a 6'5" black guy son. I was married to a black guy. My black guy thing is so wide and so deep that I can pretty much sort and figure out who that black guy is. And he was my black guy. He said, yes, ladies, I know where you're going. I'll take you there. You know, biases are the stories we make up about people before we know who they actually are. But how are we gonna know who they are when we've been told to avoid and be afraid of them?
Verne Myers returns with that answer after a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, ideas about moving beyond tolerance. Stay with us. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, everyone. Just a quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. First, to Optum, a healthcare and innovation company. Here's Optum Labs Chief Medical Officer Darshak Sanghavi on how Optum Labs and its partners are using big data to help solve some of the health system's greatest challenges.
It's only helpful when you actually know how to analyze it in ways that are meaningful. That's what we do here at Optum Labs, get those data-driven insights to help make healthcare better.
Optum, how well gets done. Learn more at optum.com/data in focus. Thanks also to Exxon and Mobil, the exclusive fuel partners of the Plenty Rewards program. 500 points is worth at least $5 in savings. You can pick up a Plenty card at an Exxon or Mobil branded station and start earning points right away. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas for moving beyond tolerance. And we're talking about things that are often very hard to talk about. Politics, the Middle East, race, a subject that can get awkward.
Yeah.
Messy.
Absolutely. But once you start experimenting, you realize, oh yeah, I said that. The person got mad at me. I apologized. It was okay.
Before the break, we were hearing from Brené Myers. She's a diversity consultant, and it's a job, as she explained in her TED Talk, where you meet a lot of people who really, honestly are trying to be good people, tolerant people. And her message to those people is always the same.
Stop trying to be good people. We need real people. You know, I do a lot of diversity work, and people will come up to me at the beginning of a workshop. They're like, oh, Miss Diversity Lady, we're so glad you're here. But we don't have a bias bone in our body. And I'm like, really? Because I do this work every day, and I see all my biases. I mean, not too long ago, I was on a plane, and I heard the voice of a woman's women pilot coming over the PA system, and I was just, like, so excited. I was so thrilled. I was like, yes, women, we are rocking it. We are now in the stratosphere, you know? It was all good, and then it started getting turbulent and bumpy, and I was like, I hope she can drive. It's like, if you ask me explicitly, I would say, female pilot, awesome. But it appears that when things get funky and a little troublesome, a little risky, I lean on a bias that I didn't even know that I had. You know, fast-moving planes in the sky, I want a guy. That's my default. Men are my default. Who is your default? Who do you trust? Who are you afraid of? Who do you implicitly feel connected to? Who do you run away from?
But there is something about humans that is very tribal, that we as a species tend to gravitate toward humans who share our backgrounds or interests or religion or culture, race or faith.
Well, I spend a lot of my time professionally and personally suggesting that we might want to overcome that tendency, which is not to name it as bad. I think if we could get people to understand that, hey, your comfort is real, like everybody wants to be in their comfort sometimes, right? It's just, what are you missing about other groups and ways of being? And can you remember that ultimately we are the same? Like, we are the same.
Okay, so what do we know that is the most effective tool in getting people to not just tolerate each other, but respect and like each other?
Contact.
Yeah.
It's so basic.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes I can put people who've been working together for a long time in an exercise for 2 minutes where they share something about their background, some part of their identity, and why it's important to them. And they will come out of that conversation going, oh my gosh, that was so powerful. That was so interesting. I feel so close. Why? Because the person moves from being a monocultural individual to someone who's multifaceted and has, it reminds you of your own humanity, and you can sort of see where you've been cutting that person off.
So I get that this would totally work in a controlled space, you know, like a safe space. But what happens when people go out into the real world? I mean, how does that feeling continue?
So here's the thing, because some people are like, well, you're asking the impossible because you want me to do like some kind of cultural sharing with someone. You know, it's like, it's not realistic.
Yeah.
You know, it's not realistic. And I'm saying, fine, except if you were in the least bit more curious about the stories you've put together, if you didn't just trust your own story so much, that's a start.
I'm saying just do an inventory. Expand your social and professional circles. Just like, who's in your circle? Who's missing? How many authentic relationships do you have with young Black people, folks, men, women, or any other major difference from who you are and how you roll, so to speak? There may be somebody at work, in your classroom, in your house of worship, somewhere. There's some Black young guy there. And you're nice. You say hi. I'm saying go deeper, closer, further. It's the empathy and the compassion that comes out of having relationships with people who are different from you, something really powerful and beautiful happens. You start to realize that they are you, that they're part of you. And then we cease to be bystanders and we become actors, we become advocates, and we become allies.
I have watched people change their worldview through contact, as in someone in their family is gay now. Their lovely son married someone from another tribe, so to speak. Their young, beautiful daughter now has a debilitating disability, and all of a sudden, their heart grows to encompass a different way of seeing this difference.
But this is hard. Like, it, to move beyond just tolerance is work. It's real work.
Yeah. And I often say people just don't, they don't give up their worldview on a regular basis, on a day-to-day basis, because it's the thing that keeps their world together. And people don't want their worlds to tremble for the most part. They want their worlds to stay sealed.
This last thing is going to be harder, and I know it, but I'm just going to put it out there anyway. When we see something, we have to have the courage to say something, even to the people we love. You know, you got to listen to the conversations around the table. You start to say things like, "Grandma's a bigot. Uncle Joe is racist." And you know, we love Grandma and we love Uncle Joe, we do. But what they're saying is wrong. And we need to be able to say something, because you know who else is at the table? The children are at the table. And we wonder why these biases don't die and move from generation to generation, because we're not saying anything. And we've got to be willing to not shelter our children from the ugliness of racism when Black parents don't have the luxury to do so, especially those who have young Black sons. We gotta take our lovely darlings, our future, and we gotta tell them we have an amazing country with incredible ideals. We have worked incredibly hard and we have made some progress, but we are not done.
You know, I totally get this thing about children, because I had this amazing experience. I think it was about 2 years ago when my now 7-year-old was 5.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and he looked at the statue and he said, "Which battle in the Revolutionary War did he lead?"
Wow.
And it was so powerful to me. I was so moved by it, because I thought, wow, to this child, he's just looking at another hero.
Well, I have to tell you that if that was my kid, young Black man, I would have said, actually, he was a hero of another war. Hmm. Our country was not willing to see him and the people that he is a part of as American. And so he reminded us of where we had gone wrong. And I would have just explained that to him, because we have these young people and these young brains, and they are willing to see the possibilities in everybody. But after a while, they start to get stained, and without the right narratives, they will make the wrong judgments often.
I mean, do you think that we're at least heading in the right direction, that, you know, that we're heading to a future that that's not just about tolerance, but that's about something much deeper?
So I will tell you what my hope is. My hope is yes. But we need grace. We need compassion. We need humility. But we are up for that. We can do that. It is not as hard as we're making it out to be. And so I believe this is the best time for anybody who has a conscience to be alive.
That's Renee Myers. You should check out her entire TED Talk at TED.com. So a few months after graduating from college, Aspen Baker was working at a bar in Berkeley, California, when she found out she was pregnant.
I was thinking I was going to be a mom. I'm pregnant, so I'm going to be a mom. And that was terrifying.
There was no other way to look at it. This was it.
Yeah. When you're pregnant, you have a baby. So that's where I was. Yeah.
For Aspen, an abortion was completely out of the question. She'd grown up in a pretty conservative home, although not in the typical way.
My parents were surfers. We grew up on the beach, and we were Christian.
Like Christian hippies, like Christian conservatives, or like a hybrid of those things?
I was certainly raised in a conservative environment. You know, abortion was wrong, and people shouldn't have abortions. But I was also raised with a very, like, God is a loving God idea.
And so when Aspen told her boyfriend that they were going to have a baby, he said he wasn't ready to be a father. And so she started to wonder about her options, whether maybe an abortion was the right choice for her or not.
Every day that I was pregnant, I would wake up one day and be like, I'm going to be a mom, and here's what this is going to look like. And, you know, I'm going to have to move back home, and I'm going to have to do this. And can you be a bartender and be pregnant? Because that's, you know, like, trying to sort of imagine what that would look like. And then the next day I'd wake up and I'd say, oh, I'm going to have an abortion. And I'd kind of spend the day thinking about, like, what that would mean and how that would feel.
This was a huge conflict for you.
Yes. I was living a very big existential crisis.
And one night after work, in the middle of that crisis, Aspen sat down with her friend Polly.
We closed up shop at 2 a.m. and we usually always had a drink together, and I didn't have a drink. And she was like, why, are you pregnant? And I was like, yes. And then she told me she'd had an abortion, and she was the first person who'd ever told me that they'd had an abortion. And I remember thinking, oh, I really like her. She seems to be doing okay. And she had an abortion, so maybe it doesn't ruin you for life.
That moment really made Aspen begin to see that women who had abortions weren't these anonymous, invisible people. They were her friends. And after thinking about it some more, Aspen decided to have an abortion. She says part of her was relieved, but then there was another really big question she was facing.
I just did this thing that I said I would never do. And, well, who am I now? I found out that a lot of other people in my life had had abortions, but they hadn't told me because they knew that I identified as pro-life. And that was one of the most heartbreaking things to realize.
They thought you would judge them.
They thought I would judge them. And so they never told me about theirs. And it wasn't until I had mine and told them that they felt safe enough. And that broke my heart.
And it was at that point when Aspen realized that even though we hear so much talk about abortion rights and debates and laws and regulations, we don't hear nearly as much from the women who actually have abortions and their stories.
Because when you start talking to real people about their real experiences, it gets much more messy and much more chaotic and much more difficult to fit easily into a box. And that seemed important. It seemed important to kind of disrupt this black and white, you know, us versus them. Are you with us? Are you against us kind of thinking with more humanity?
So about 15 years ago, Aspen decided to start an organization called Exhale. And it's a place where women can get support after an abortion, free of any judgment. Aspen explained how it works on the TED stage.
The first thing we did was create a talk line where women and men could call to get emotional support. Free of judgment and politics, believe it or not, nothing like our service had ever existed. And we needed a new framework that could hold all the experiences that we were hearing on our talk line. The feminist who regrets her abortion, the Catholic who's grateful for hers, the personal experiences that weren't fitting neatly into one box or the other. And we didn't think it was right to ask women to pick a side. We wanted to show them that the whole world was on their side as they were going through this deeply personal experience. So we invented ProVoice. Listening and storytelling are the hallmarks of ProVoice practice. Listening and storytelling. That sounds pretty nice. Sounds maybe easy. We could all do that. It's not easy. It's very hard. And if we truly listen to one another, we will hear things that demand that we shift our own perceptions.
It's very complicated because even the language that we use around abortion is almost intolerant. Like, that person is anti-choice. That person is pro-choice. That person is pro-life. This person is pro-abortion. Nobody really agrees on the language.
Yeah, the language becomes this way to not have the conversation.
Yeah.
And so we kind of label the other side, and then we're offended by the way that they label us. And then it becomes like a fight about the labels. So if we come at it in a different way, though, and if we start from the place that's personal, it really changes the tone and it changes the climate. These are not debate skills.
Yeah.
This is not about an argument. This is about our shared human connection. So let's talk about listening and how to be a good listener. One is to ask open-ended questions. You can ask yourself or someone that you know, how are you feeling? What was that like? What do you hope for? So another way to be pro-voice is to share stories. And one risk that you take on when you share your story with someone else is that given the same set of circumstances as you, they might actually make a different decision. For example, if you are telling a story about your abortion, realize that she might have had the baby. She might have placed for adoption. She might have felt relief and confidence, even though you felt sad and lost. This is okay. Empathy gets created the moment we imagine ourselves in someone else's shoes. It doesn't mean that we all have to end up in the same place. It's not agreement. It's not sameness that ProVoice is after. It creates a culture and a society that values what makes us special and unique. And it generates the empathy that we need to overcome all the ways that we try to hurt one another.
Espen Baker returns in just a minute. Our show today, Ideas for Moving Beyond Tolerance. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, everyone. Just a quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help make this podcast possible. First, to Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to automatically calculate and print the correct amount of postage for every letter or package you send. You'll have all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right at your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer. Sign up for Stamps.com for a special offer, a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter NPR. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Thanks also to Rackspace, offering fully managed hosting for the world's most demanding digital workloads. Rackspace hosts more than half of the Fortune 100 across 150 countries with a powerful combination of certified expertise and around-the-clock support. They can design, build, and optimize a single-tenant solution that meets your most stringent security and performance requirements. Learn more at rackspace.com/NPR. Hey, and one more thing before we get back to the show. If you know a curious kid between the ages of 5 and 10, let them know about NPR's newest podcast, a podcast especially for kids called Wow in the World. It's about science, wonder, and all the amazing discoveries happening in the world around us. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or at wowintheworld.com. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about how to move beyond tolerance on some of the most polarizing, politicized issues in the world. And we were just hearing from Aspen Baker. She runs an organization called Exhale. It provides support to women after they have abortions. Aspen calls herself pro-voice, and that basically means that she just listens to people's stories in a non-judgmental way. And that's something quite different from the charged conversations we typically hear about abortion.
And so the important part of how we unlock that conflict and unlock that polarization is to find out what we're not hearing, what we're missing, what's hidden, what's underneath. And that is the voices and experiences of women who have had abortions and their friends and loved ones.
You know, Aspen, part of, I think, what might make it so hard to find common ground about abortion is that, you know, there are people who really who see it as murder, that it is, mm-hmm. it's something that is an act of violence. And so it's got to be really hard for that person to, you know, sort of be tolerant towards somebody who's had an abortion.
I think that it's very hard to be tolerant, period, of people who do things that you disagree with and who you think that are bad or wrong or immoral. There's no easy, simple solution about, like, you know, if you just really think about it in this way.
Yeah.
That's not how it's going to work. I think that there's often an assumption that women who are having abortions don't know what they're doing, or that they aren't having the same moral or ethical quandaries as everybody else. And I think that is the opportunity, that if we understand and give room to sort of hear, how did you navigate your values and beliefs as you are making the decision to have an abortion? That is a very different way into the conversation than to just say it's all right or it's all wrong.
Do you think that we'll ever get to a point where the topic of abortion will be something that we can talk about in a depoliticized way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that I don't think that the political conversation about abortion will ever go away, and I don't think it necessarily should go away. But what I would like to see is that it is no longer the only conversation that is available to us about abortion, and that there becomes much more of a human conversation, even if we have different political beliefs about it. So last year, I was pregnant again. This time, I was looking forward to the birth of my son. And while pregnant, I had never been asked how I was feeling so much in all my life. And however I replied, whether I was feeling wonderful and excited or scared and totally freaked out, there was always someone there giving me a been there response. It was awesome. It was a welcome, yet dramatic departure from what I experience when I talk about my mixed feelings of my abortion. Far beyond definition as single right or wrong decisions, our experiences can exist on a spectrum. Pro-Voice focuses that conversation on human experience, and it makes support and respect possible for all. Thank you.
Aspen Baker is the founder and executive director of Exhale. You can check out her entire TED Talk at TED.com. Okay, so far on the show, we've covered politics, race, abortion, all topics where people cannot stand, let alone tolerate, the other side's point of view. So we thought, let's push it a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely.
Israel-Palestine, a place where tolerating each other definitely has not worked.
Living in a conflict zone is quite a traumatic thing.
This is Aziz Abu Sara. He's Palestinian, and he grew up in East Jerusalem.
When I went to school, when I was 6, 7 years old, my mom would give me an onion every morning. Now, it wasn't because that was my lunch. It was because an onion is what we believed helps if you shot at tear gas.
And if tear gas is shot at you, you would use
it. You cut an onion and you put it close to your nose, and if you inhale it, the idea is you won't pass out. And that was one of the important things. Every morning, you know, normally the moms will figure out the sandwich and the, do you have your homework? My mom would make sure I have my onion. You know, having soldiers on the way being checked or shot at even, that was not an abnormal thing. It was a normal lifestyle.
What was your perception of Jews or Israelis?
Oh, when I was a child, my understanding was an occupier, an attacker, somebody who limits my freedom, somebody who wants to kill me, somebody who hates me. That's the only thing I knew. And my only interaction were with soldiers and the settlers who we didn't like each other. I didn't have access to anybody else to give me a different point of view.
But today, Aziz works on building relationships between Palestinians and Israelis, between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. And he uses a tool that might surprise you. We'll get to what he does and his TED Talk in a bit. But how he came to do this, it actually started with his older brother, Taysir, who he kind of worshipped as a kid.
He was more of a parent for me than really a brother.
That's because Aziz was the youngest of seven kids. And by the time he was born, his parents kind of had their hands full.
You know, when I went to school my first day, he was the person who took me to school. When I had a problem with my teachers, he's the one who showed up. When I had my birthday, he's the one who set up my birthday party.
They weren't just close. Taysir meant everything to Aziz. And so it's why he was absolutely crushed when one morning, Israeli soldiers came looking for his brother.
It was Ramadan. We were woken up around 5 in the morning, and the soldiers came into our room, asked everyone for their ID. And when they saw his ID, they asked him to go with them. We didn't hear anything for quite a while. Eventually, my dad found out that he was suspected of throwing rocks and that he eventually confessed. We knew only later that he held on and refused to confess, and he was beaten up until he did. But by the time he did, he had quite a lot of health damage.
Was he eventually released?
Yes, but he didn't spend much time home, because right away after he was taken to the hospital, and he died exactly a year after he was arrested.
What was the cause that they gave?
He had internal injuries. He had a spleen failure, had a liver failure, and they had nothing they could do to save him. And so to me, it was very clear that somebody was responsible, and the somebody was the Israeli soldiers who arrested him.
How did that change your life and the way you looked at the world?
It felt to me like as if somebody has punched me in the face. And my reaction was, I want to hit back. I want the person who killed my brother to feel the pain. But I was 10 years old, so I didn't know what even that means. What do you do? I just became angry, I became bitter, and I started looking for ways to seek revenge.
And that meant going to protests and throwing stones at Israeli soldiers.
When somebody kills your brother, you hate them. And when you only know of that society, only those people, only the soldiers, the only memory I had was the soldiers, and the only encounter I have is negative. So hatred, bitterness, anger, all of these were emotions that I had all through that period.
And that's how Aziz spent most of his teenage years, reeling from his brother's death and thinking about vengeance. But as he got older, he had to figure out what to do with his life. And he had to grapple with a reality of growing up in this part of the world.
Without Hebrew in Jerusalem, you can't really do anything.
If you don't speak Hebrew there, it's a lot harder to get a good job.
I didn't speak Hebrew because I thought of it as the language of the enemy, and I was not gonna learn it.
But Hebrew meant opportunity. So Aziz found an intensive Hebrew class actually meant for Jewish immigrants to Israel.
And I signed up for one of those with the thought that I'm going to go and learn the language, but not talk to anybody. I don't like the people there. I'm not going to connect with anyone. I'm just there to learn the language.
You kind of have to talk to people to practice.
Right. And it was an incredible experience because I get to the class and the teachers were just amazing. I kept thinking, why are they so nice? This doesn't fit into what I know about the Israelis. And then as we started talking about other things, I realized, yeah, we are very similar. We are extremely similar. And that was, I think, a major change of heart for me.
Explain to me what was starting to happen in your mind. I mean, was this challenging your identity?
It was an identity crisis. It made me question everything I grew up with. It made me question, what about everything else I know? What is right and what is wrong? If that narrative wasn't fully right, then what other narratives are also not right? And suddenly the whole dynamic changed, where to me it stopped being us versus them.
And that was simply because of face-to-face interaction?
It was because of face-to-face interaction, but also the kind of people I talked to treated me like a human being, like somebody who has the same rights that they do, somebody who saw me as equal to them. And to hear that from an Israeli, from a Jewish person, just changed everything for me because they weren't on the other side. And so that Hebrew class has opened a whole new world to me.
And that's when Aziz decided to devote his life to building genuine, real relationships between Palestinians and Israelis, relationships that went beyond just tolerating each other. And so he started by learning about the Holocaust. And it was something he kind of had heard about, but he'd never really tried to understand. So he first went to Yad Vashem, which is Israel's Holocaust Memorial Museum.
I was shocked by the atrocities and by the pain, and I found myself sympathizing.
He got a job in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhood.
And I was the only Palestinian there and loved the place, loved the food.
He joined a support group for Israelis and Palestinians who lost family members in the conflict.
It was hard, but we realized just the amount of misunderstanding is unbelievable.
And all this in an effort to build the kinds of relationships he built in his first Hebrew class. And in the end, he came up with a kind of surprising idea that the key to moving beyond tolerance might be tourism.
We realize millions of people come into Israel and Palestine and they leave very one-sided. They either go visit the Israeli side or the Palestinian side and they never encounter the other side. And we thought there's a big problem with that. And so we wanted to do something different.
And so what they decided to do, Aziz explained on the TED stage.
You might be wondering, really, can tourism change things? Can it bring down walls? Yes, tourism is the best sustainable way to bring down those walls and to create sustainable way of connecting with each other and creating friendships. In 2009, I co-founded Mejdi Tours, a social enterprise that aims to connect people with two Jewish friends, by the way. And for example, in Jerusalem, we would have two tour guides, one Israeli and one Palestinian, guiding the trips together, telling history and narrative and archaeology and conflict from totally different perspectives. Imagine with me, if the 1 billion people who travel internationally every year travel like this, not being taken in the bus from one side to another, from one hotel to another, taking pictures from the windows of their buses of people and cultures, but actually connecting with people. You know, I remember having a Muslim group from the UK going to a house of an Orthodox Jewish family and having their first Friday night dinners, a Sabbath dinner, and eating together chamin, which is a Jewish food, a stew. Just having the connection of realizing after a while that 100 years ago, their families came out of the same place in Northern Africa. This is not a photo profile for your Facebook. This is not disaster tourism. This is the future of travel.
We try to show the complexity and say, We're not here to tell you what really to believe. This is not a propaganda trip. This is a trip to show you a place, to show you the real thing about the place, to hopefully inspire you to care about this place and to leave here thinking and feeling, what can I do to help these people, to have compassion on them? You could still be more pro-Israel or more pro-Palestine. That is likely to happen. But maybe you would leave with more compassion. That's our hope.
It's interesting because asking people to be tolerant isn't that hard. I mean, asking people to tolerate with contempt somebody who lives down the street, but to just deal with it, it's not that big of a challenge. Most people can handle that. It's the next step that's hard.
Yep. It's reconciliation, which is what we were trying to do. We realized what we needed wasn't tolerance, but was more reconciliation, bringing people to understand each other, bringing people to see themselves as one, realizing our pain is similar, that our blood color are the same, that our tears are as bitter. And having that understanding made a difference. But think about it. We grow up, regardless, not only Israel and Palestine, it's true here in America, it's true everywhere. You grow up with propaganda. And it is very hard to change that unless we change the narrative. If we can do this, I think there's no way this conflict could survive, or any conflict. I think it will make a big change.
That's Aziz Abu Sara. His company is called Mejdi Tours. You can see his entire TED Talk at TED.com. Hey, thanks for listening to our show Beyond Tolerance this week. If you want to find out more about who was on it, go to ted.npr.org. To see hundreds more TED Talks, check out ted.com. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Neva Grant, with help from Daniel Shukin. Our intern is Maria Paz Gutierrez. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. If you want to let us know what you think about the show, you can write us at tedradiohour@npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. It's @tedradiohour. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. My new podcast is called It's Been a Minute.
That's another way of saying, let's catch up. Every Friday, I'll sit down with two guests, smart talkers from inside and outside NPR, to catch up on the week of news and culture, everything.
If you can't stop watching the news, but you're also exhausted by doing that, this show is for you. Don't miss out.
Find It's Been a Minute now on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Thanks.